And I guess we're ready to go. And we are in Deuteronomy 16, which begins with Passover and then other feasts, and then goes into a thing on the judges, which was somewhat unexpected in the scope of it. So 16 verse 1, observe the month of Abib and keep the Passover to the Lord your God. For in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. By the way, the Jewish calendar has alternate names for some of their months. Wouldn't that be fun? It's also known as the month of Nisan. Okay. Verse 2.
Therefore you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to put his name.
Okay. You shall eat no unleavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, that all the days of your life you may remember the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. So the bread of affliction, what's the meaning of that? First is how they came out in haste and there was no time to let the bread rise. But then secondly, why they came out in haste was because that was the place where they were slaves. And so all of that is a memory of that. Verse 4.
No leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory for 7 days. Nor shall any of the flesh that you sacrifice on the evening of the first day remain all night until morning.
And that was the command for the first Passover, that what was not eaten that night was to be burned. You didn't save it for leftovers. There's no Passover leftovers. Verse 5, you may not offer the Passover sacrifice within any of your towns that the Lord your God is giving you. Verse 6.
Except in the place he will choose as a dwelling for his name, there you must sacrifice the Passover in the evening when the sun goes down on the anniversary of your departure from Egypt.
Okay. And that's why the Jews went up to Jerusalem for the Passover. Verse 7, and you shall cook it and eat it at the place that the Lord your God will choose. And in the morning you shall turn and go to your tents. Or when they got into Israel, to their houses. Verse 8.
For 6 days.
Go ahead.
6 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a sacred assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work on it.
Okay. Not much in terms of added notes for that section. Verse 9, you shall count 7 weeks. Begin to count the 7 weeks from the time the sickle is first put into the standing grain. Verse 10.
Then celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God by giving a freewill offering in proportion to the blessing the Lord your God has given you.
Okay. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, the Levite who is within your towns, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are among you at the place that the Lord your God will choose to make his name dwell there. And verse 12 before comments.
You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes.
So the Feast of Weeks is what we call Pentecost, the 50th day. 7 weeks, and then comes the 50th day. And on the 50th day, it is a celebration of the first fruits of gathering. And the symbolism goes from the harvest to the harvest from among the nations, the gathering and of people. And at that point, the people of Israel would celebrate the nations coming in. So the sojourner was included in the feast. And in that feast, you remember that every 3 years they were to take a tithe of the produce of the land, and that was to be given to, well, to the Levites, the sojourners, the fatherless, the widows, the orphans, for provision so that no one would go hungry. And the third year, the sixth year, and then came the Sabbath year. And on the Sabbath year, those who were poor or were sojourners could go through the fields and glean. And on it went. And that's in part why that section finishes with verse 12. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt. Be careful to observe these things. And then it goes on to, let's say there's the 7 days of the Passover, the 7 weeks to the Feast of Weeks, then the seventh month to the Feast of Booths. Verse 13, you shall keep the Feast of Booths 7 days when you have gathered in the produce from your threshing floor and your wine press. Verse 14.
You shall rejoice in your feast, and you and your son and your daughter, your male servant and your female servant, the Levite, the sojourner, the fatherless, and the widow who are within your towns.
Okay. I'm going to come back to that and test it a bit further. For 7 days you shall keep the feast to the Lord your God at the place that the Lord will choose, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you will be altogether joyful. So this is a feast also to include everyone. To pull a figure from one of the animated series, The Simpsons, what about the crazy cat lady? Is she included in the feast?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. This is a reaching out. This is a include everybody.
Okay, I think I just found out which dog is pooping on our yard.
Oh, you saw one.
Mm-hmm. An old man. Yeah, an old man walking his dog.
Okay. You gonna chase out the door after him?
Nope.
Go and fetch the poop and run after him and give it back to him?
Nope.
There was no running, just throwing.
No, he's an old man. He can hardly walk. He's walking a dog, so I'm not gonna.
Okay.
Shoot. I've been harboring all this ill will for the last year.
So the crazy cat lady and the old dog walking guy.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And it pushes the Israelites, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Verse 16.
Three times a year, all your men must appear before the Lord your God at the place he will choose, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, and the Feast of Tabernacles. No man should appear before the Lord empty-handed.
Mm-hmm. Every man shall give as he is able, according to the blessings of the Lord your God that he has given you. And so the acknowledgement of the blessings works two ways. It works in returning back to God with thanks, and it moves in the direction of passing on the blessings to those who are in need. And now comes time for a huge shift. Verse 18.
Appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly.
Okay. So what are the three offices of Christ?
Prophet, priest, king.
What was that?
Prophet, priest, and king.
Prophet, priest, and king. Do the judges fit within that? No, they do not. It's kind of like a fourth thing. And there will be a book that is written with the title of Judges. So it was an office that was set up for very specific purposes in Israel. And it is distinct from the office of king. It's distinct from the prophet. It's distinct from the priestly order or the Levites, although the Levites have some connection with the office of judge. But the office of judge is that other part. And then we begin to explore what exactly is this. Verse 19, you shall not pervert justice, you shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. So throughout the Pentateuch, and it would go on from there, judges are commanded to show no partiality to the rich, nor are they to favor the poor. They are not to be advocates or defenders of anybody in any way, shape, or form. They are not to be a respecter of persons. And the term respecter of persons is a term that is used of God. It is then used of Jesus. We know that you are no respecter of persons, which means your situation, that doesn't enter into questions of justice. Simply what is true, what is right, what is according to the law, period. And this is hammered home all through the Old Testament. The justices are not to be advocates, defenders, or those that stand up for those who are oppressed in society. That's not their role. Their role is simply to judge on the basis of truth, on the basis of the law of God. Period. That means the rich man can't take the judge out for an evening on the town and then get a favorable decision later. It means that the poor is not to expect for the sake of his poverty that something will be in his favor. Period, period, period. Like I said, this is just absolutely hammered home.
And we need people like that in our day.
Yeah. In that vein, then we continue on with the definitions. Verse 20.
You shall follow what is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God is giving you.
Yeah. Or an ESV translation, justice and only justice. Like I said, it's hammering it home. And it's, I don't care if the king or if the king's wife or if the king's son is the one that did something wrong, justice and only justice. And it is only under those circumstances that every person in the nation can expect to be treated on an equal footing with everyone else. This is the place where, see, in the workplace, the guy that is the owner and the owner's son gets special treatment, but in the court, nobody gets special treatment. Verse 21 turns to something else, and as it goes back and forth between these two themes, there will be further definition of what the judge and the justice aspect of the national life is. So 21, you shall not plant any tree as an Asherah beside the altar of the Lord your God that you shall make. Well, what is an Asherah?
Is that an idol?
Is it
my translation says wooden image.
Is it time to say it very bluntly?
Isn't she a fertility goddess?
Mm-hmm. An Asherah is a tree that is planted to be a fertility symbol. And evergreens were quite favored in fertility symbolism because the life is in them throughout the winter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Asherah, alternate name Ashtaroth, the goddess Asherah or Ashtaroth was also understood as a consort to Baal. You know what a consort is? A consort is your sweet thing on the side. Even if you have a wife or if you don't have a wife, that's the idea. You do not set that thing up next to the altar of the Lord. I mean, talk about placement and being offensive. Okay, verse 22.
And you shall not set up a pillar which the Lord your God hates.
Yep. Again. By the way, I read recently that there were certain people who found out that at a certain park in San Francisco, there was a stone pillar set up that they decided to treat like an Asherah or a fertility pole. And so they began making sacrifices to this stone pillar that was set up to block the entrance of motorized vehicles into the park.
Was that during the hippie era?
No, no.
More recently?
That was within the last 10 years.
Ew, people are stupid.
Yeah, we'll just tend to move on. Verse chapter 17, verse 1. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep in which is a blemish, any defect whatever, for that is an abomination to the Lord your God. And this would, of course, be willingly do that. If you didn't realize there was a defect, didn't see it, after you had inspected the sheep, you would not be called out for an abomination. It would be disallowed, but.
Yeah, the money changers in the temple disallowed a lot of sheep that had no blemish.
Yep. And that's part of why the crowds cheered Jesus on. Because the crowds went up to the Passover, they had their sheep, they found out they couldn't sacrifice their sheep and use it for the Passover because their sheep had some blemish that the authorities found in it. And then, you know, if they hung around afterwards, after the priests had bought their sheep for a nice, very low price and sold them another sheep for a very expensive price, if they hung around the temple grounds, they'd find their sheep brought across the middle, sprinkle a little bit of water, put in a different pen. Now it's declared clean for sale at multiple times the price. And when Jesus overturned the tables of the money changers in the temple, how do you think that came off to the crowd that had been built? Yeah. Verse 2.
If there is found among you within any of your gates, which the Lord your God gives you, a man or a woman who has been wicked in the sight of the Lord your God in transgressing his covenant.
Okay, that's the important phrase, in transgressing his covenant. What does that mean? Verse 3. And has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the host of heaven, which I have forbidden. So they turned away from worship of God to nature worship, which, you know, shedding blood and sacrifices offered to the starry host and Baal and Asherah and fertility rites and on and on and on. Verse 4.
And this has been brought to your attention, then you must investigate it thoroughly. If it is true, and it has been proved that this detestable thing has been done in Israel,
then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has done this evil thing, and you shall stone that man or woman to death with stones. The gates were the places where you seek entry to the city, either granted or denied. It was the place where the elders of the city would sit and they would decide cases. And outside the gates was the place of separation, not only from the city, but the separation from God, outside the gates. And there's more here. Verse 6.
On the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness.
So what that means is, if there's only one witness, case dismissed, it's thrown out. Two or three witnesses, you then investigate thoroughly. Now, if it's found that the two or three witnesses are enemies of that person and have been airing around things to try and get that person in trouble, you call that into question. That's what it means by investigate thoroughly. You do not simply say, oh, there's two witnesses, put him to death, put her to death. That's not what's being said. If there isn't the two or three witnesses, it's disqualified. If there is, it goes to the next step, which is investigation. And verse 7, this is another restriction. The hand of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of the people, so you shall purge the evil from your midst. Dalich points out, and he gets this from somebody else, who says, there are people who will voice things around, and the sin of the lips and the sin of what you say is something that they'll be perfectly willing to do. We know this. But you go the next step and say, okay, the case has been proven to the best of our knowledge, but you have to be the one to start the execution. Will there be some who then will back off from that? It is one more step in calling them out. You better be sure of what you're saying. Otherwise, you have the blood of an innocent person on your hands to stand before God on the day of judgment and try and explain that. And according to Dalich, that's why that provision is put in place. But if you take that and you go into the New Testament with that, what do you find in John chapter 8? The woman caught in adultery, and they bring her before Jesus. And what does Jesus say about who's to cast the first stone?
He who is without sin.
Without sin.
He doesn't say, let the witnesses cast the first stone.
No.
And after they've all gone away, starting from the oldest to the youngest, because the youngest are the slowest to catch on to this whole idea. They're all eager and everything. But after they've gone away, he then says to the woman, woman, where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you? And she says, no one, Lord. And what does he say then?
And neither do I.
Oh, neither do I. Is he a witness?
Yeah.
He is the first witness who, in those words, he claims the right of being the witness who has the right to cast the first stone. But see, if no one is willing to cast that first stone, then the execution cannot continue. He has preempted the witnesses, claiming the right of being the first witness. And then as the first witness, he will not, chooses not to cast the first stone. And then he says to her, what?
Go and sin no more.
Yeah. Which when you compare that to what is here, it makes it even more remarkable what he does. Okay. More about judges and a little bit about priests. Verse 8.
If a matter arises which is too hard for you to judge between degrees of guilt for bloodshed, between one judgment or another, or between one punishment or another, matters of controversy within your gates, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses.
Ah, yes. The literal Hebrew. Too difficult for judgment. Between blood and blood, plea and plea, stroke and stroke. Yeah, it's like, who did what? Can't figure it out. In the case of a death, who started it? In the case of assault, who started it? In the case of legal right, this one or that one. So in that case, you go up to the place that the Lord your God will choose, and there will be something there. What is it that there will be there? Verse 9, and you shall come to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office in these days, and you shall consult them, and they shall declare to you the decision. So there was apparently to be a judge, and that office of the judge was, this was a judge of Israel. Really? So this thing with the judges and the book of Judges, that was set up in Deuteronomy. And assisting with the judicial things were the Levites that were there. They were sort of the clerks of court who would look into things and back into the writings and the writings of Moses and the writings of the rabbis and the writings of this and the writings of that and precedent and everything else. But there was to be a judge. And this was to the side, sort of going parallel to all of the other things in Israel. There was one time where a man came to Jesus and said, Rabbi, tell my brother to share the inheritance with me. And Jesus said to him, man, who made me arbiter or judge over you? And the office of the rabbi will not impinge on the office of the judge. The office of the prophet will not. The office of the king will not. It was seen as a completely separated thing where there was to be impartiality, not pushing of a point of view, nothing of the sort. Okay. Verse 10.
Then you shall do according to what they declare to you from that place that the Lord will choose. And you shall be careful to do according to all that they direct you.
Who is this then spoken to? That verse, according to Delitzsch, is to the judges in the various towns who have said, we can't figure this out. Let's go up to the place God has chosen and set this in front of them. And when the decision comes down, this is not subject to appeals and this and that and relitigation and everything else. You follow their decision. Verse 11, according to the instructions that they give you and according to the decision which they pronounce to you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the verdict that they declare to you, either to the right hand or to the left, either to greater severity or to lenience. You have to go according to the decision. Verse 12.
The man who shows contempt for the judge or for the priest who stands ministering there to the Lord your God must be put to death. You must purge the evil from Israel.
Because when justice is undermined, the whole thing falls apart. Verse 13, and all the people shall hear and fear and not act presumptuously again. So if a judge refuses to follow the decision, which is final, and acts presumptuously and is put to death, what happens the next time that something comes along and somebody wants to just not follow the law? There is that threat hanging over them, and everything holds together. Now, what about the king? Verse 14.
When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me.
Yeah. Philistines down the street, they have a king. Babylonians have a king. Why can't we have a king? We want a king. Give us a king. Why can't we have a king? If the Philistines or the Babylonians jumped off the bridge, would you do it? Yes, we want a king. Yeah. You may indeed set a king over you whom the Lord your God will choose. Okay, so he gets the choice. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Ah. Okay, now let's see the directions for a king and ask ourselves the question, did the kings follow those directions? Verse 16.
Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again.
Okay. Did they follow that? Let's add in verse 17. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold.
Solomon did all that, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Verse 18.
And when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law, approved by the Levitical priests.
So he's supposed to sit on his throne and copy the Bible by hand?
Sure.
Would that be useful? It'd be more
help him remember
our
it.
Our leaders are doing. Our leaders are running off writing books and every kind of stuff that they can put on paper and sell. You know, let them sit there and write their own personal copy of the Bible. It might help. Verse 19, and it shall be with him, and he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them. Verse 20, and this is telling.
Not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or to the left, then he and his descendants will reign a long time over his kingdom in Israel.
Okay. ESV translation of the first part, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers. That was a good step two translation. But wow. Keep him humble, because the ruler who considers himself better than his fellow citizens is just not the kind that you want to rule.
They didn't stay humble, though, did they?
No, they didn't. Keeping on going, because now we're going to talk about prophets in a while. The Levitical priests, all the tribe of Levi, shall have no portion or inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the Lord's food offerings as their inheritance. Verse 2.
Therefore, they shall have no inheritance among their brethren. The Lord is their inheritance, as he said to them.
And this shall be the priest's due from the people, from those offering a sacrifice, whether an ox or a sheep. They shall give to the priest the shoulder and the two cheeks and the stomach. Okay. Verse 4.
The first fruits of your grain, of your wine, and of your oil, and the first fleece of your sheep you shall give him.
And what's he to do with the fleece of the sheep? Then you're talking about carding and spinning and weaving and... Yeah. So the wife of the priest has to learn all these things.
Already knows them.
What?
She probably already knows them. She
grew up. Yeah. From the time she could sit at a spinning wheel.
Verse 4.
Well, that's the one we just did. What, 5?
Verse 5. For the Lord your God has chosen him out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the name of the Lord, him and his sons for all time. Verse 6.
So if a Levite comes from any of your gates, from where he dwells among all Israel, and comes with all the desires of his mind to the place which the Lord chooses.
And ministers in the name of the Lord his God, like all his fellow Levites who stand to minister there before the Lord. Verse 8.
Then he may have equal portions to eat besides what he receives from the sale of his patrimony.
Meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain there, the sale of his patrimony. The priests could have houses, and the houses could be sold, and the houses could be passed down generation to generation. So instead of reading patrimony, read inheritance. And then you get closer to the whole idea. But at this point, it's time to turn to the office of the prophet. And we get into the office of the prophet first by looking at what you don't do. When you come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominable practices of those nations. The practices of those nations were to try and figure out through force of nature sacrifices and force of nature gods, goddesses, whatever, what the future would bring, what are some of the things that they did. Verse 10.
There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer.
Anyone who practices witchcraft or divination, fortune tellers, interpreters of omens. What does it mean when you cut open a sheep and the intestines have this particular shape? What does it mean when you put the tea leaves in the tea and stir it a ritual number of times this direction and that direction? What form does do the tea leaves take on the bottom of the cup? And what can you determine about what is about to happen? Because in their minds, don't you know everything is connected? And so when something happens in this way, that's a force of nature acting, and the force of nature acting in that way can influence the events that are to come in this way. And if you keep records of all of those things, then you can figure out what's going to happen tomorrow. And that was a big business. And you don't do that because who is in charge of tomorrow?
God.
Yeah. He owns tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So don't go chasing after Baal to ask him. I had somebody ask me a few years back. They said, I have this friend who's deeply into astrology and wants to know my sign so they can do a horoscope for me. What should I tell them? And I said, tell them that your sign is not any of the 12 that they're thinking of. Your sign is the sign of the cross, and under the cross you live your life.
That's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's also an accurate answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because none of those other things can have any power over us because we are marked by the sign of the cross. Okay, verse 11. Or a charmer, might be a charmer of snakes, or a medium, or a necromancer, or one who inquires of the dead. I had a friend who compared Ouija boards and inquiring of the dead and of the spirits. He said it was like throwing a ball over a fence, and if something throws it back, well, the problem is you don't know what threw it back.
Yeah.
You want to get into that game when the throwing the ball is into the spirit world and it comes back. You don't know. You know, our sign is the sign of the cross. Verse 12.
For all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord your God drives them out. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry, I skipped. drives them out from before you.
Okay. Yeah, they did all these things. The full measure of terrible and awful things. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. Verse 14.
The nations you will dispossess, listen to those who practice sorcery or divination. But as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so.
Yeah, because who owns tomorrow? It's God. And now verse 15, a famous verse. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen. Finally, who does that point to?
Jesus.
Okay. Is there anything that happens before the finally? Yeah. There are prophets from among the people of Israel all the way from here through the rest of the Old Testament. And those prophets who are sent by God are to be listened to. And it makes a huge difference to have the word of the Lord there. And we can revisit the whole business of prophecy and the prophets later on as we go, because there'll be all kinds of opportunity to do that. But this goes back to Mount Sinai, verse 16.
Just as you desired of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God or see this great fire anymore, lest I die.
Mm-hmm. And the Lord said to me, they are right in what they have spoken. Okay. Verse 18, which is the verse that is normally used pointing forward to Jesus, verse 18.
I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him.
Okay. A prophet like you. And it says later on at the end of this book, and there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses since those days. And so if it is to be a prophet like Moses, every one of the prophets in the Old Testament fell short. And it's only when we get to the New Testament and to Jesus that we find a prophet like Moses and indeed greater than Moses. Verse 19. And whoever will not listen to my words that he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. And so if you will not listen to Jesus, you got to answer for that. But on the other hand, what about all of those others? Verse 20.
But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded him to say, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods must be put to death.
Yep, because when prophecy is corrupted, truth is lost. And if you say in your heart, how may we know the word that the Lord has not spoken? Okay. Answer, verse 22, which is where we end, verse 22.
When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken, it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him.
Oh, well, that's a nice shift in, instead of saying, put him to death, to say, you shall not be afraid of him. You don't have to fear this guy who's carrying on. And when the fear of a prophet or soothsayer is gone, if it's a false prophet or a false soothsayer.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah. If it is one of those and the fear of them is gone, then their power is gone. Because the only power they have is the intimidation and the what happens if we don't obey. But if that's gone, then you're free. Free to go back to your Bible and to knowing the word of the Lord. That becomes a good place to finish.